So, let me discuss a little bit the numerical result again, in order to have some hint about the way of finding generalized solution for this minimization problem. So let me, I think I can use both. Yeah. So you remember that we were trying to solve numerically. So I didn't tell you about the scheme, but about finding the shortest path between the identity map on the unit interval and the hat function, for instance. And we had this funny picture where you can see the interpolation, the different steps in between. So this is the geodesic curves viewed at some different time. So this is the first at the beginning. This is the end point, and in between you have these pictures, right? So clearly, so each of these functions, you have the on the horizontal axis. This is the initial position of the particle, and along the vertical axis, this is the position of the particle at some given time. And you see that this is of course a discrete approximation, but you see that this is at a very microscopic scale, using the space discretization, this would be a single-valued function. But there are a lot of oscillations, and so actually what you observe and what you guess for the limit as the space and the time discretization will go to zero is to have a generalized function in the sense of Young's measure, if you are familiar with this kind of object. So, which means that instead of a function, we have a probability-valued function of the initial position in the final position.
Sorry, Jan, can you say what differs the different pictures in the sequence?
Yeah, so this is talking about the problem of finding shortest path on the group of volume-preserving diffeomorphism, and so I do a computation in the closure of this group for the L2 norm, which includes many maps, including this one-dimensional map, for instance. And so we can do that numerically quite easily. And this is what you get from the computer. So you don't get... you could have expected to have a family of volume-preserving map like this, but actually you have mixtures. So maybe for you, I can just show you again another picture in a different case, which was this one. For instance, this is for the... If you wish to reach, as a final map, this one, the C map, which is orientation reversing. The D map, which is orientation preserving with a jump, the picture would look quite different. It would look like that. The interpolation would be like this. So here is a family of volume preserving map. There is no mixture, you know? And so you see that we are going from here to there, and at the midpoint you have this non-invertible map. So, we can actually, it is pretty clear that the mixture is due to the fact that some part of the final map are orientation reversing.
Is that due to the fact that there are no rank 1 orientation
reversing? Could be. I don't know. I've never thought in these terms. Well, actually, in the 1D case, I guess it's a very reasonable conjecture to show that any time you have a orientation reversing part in the final map, there will be a mixture like that. And actually, this is easier to understand if we go to a different kind of picture, which is a more Lagrangian picture. So let me consider again this the picture on the left first. Now, if we plot the result in a different way, so here we have at different time the map. Here, what I draw is I follow each particle. So the horizontal axis here is the same as here. So this is the initial position of the particle, but this axis is a time now. It's a time axis. So each curve corresponds to the trajectory of a particle. So for instance, in this case, you see that the final map, in the final map, the points located on the right half part of the interval are assigned to go to the left part, right? This is the meaning of this piece of graph. I mean, this particle will end up on this, on the right part of the interval, and conversely. So it's really a map which exchange rigidly the two subintervals, like this. And you have to do the motion in a generalized incompressible fashion. So which means that, of course, they have to flow through each other. And so the motion is like this. So you see that a vertical line means that the particle doesn't move, because this is the space axis and this is the time axis. So what happens, which is a little bit surprising, that these particles, they don't feel anything for a while. And suddenly there is a wave coming from the east. And and then they have to move a little bit to the east, and conversely. And you can also see that there is a singularity here and there, and actually all the we will see that in some sense the kinetic energy is preserved in time, and the kinetic energy is fully concentrated at this point at time zero and there. So there is a concentration of kinetic energy and a blow up, and then focusing again. So you see the picture is. Shows that in terms of velocity field, in this case you have clearly a two-valued velocity field. That is, at each point x, if you take the intermediate time one half here, and you follow the x-axis, you see that at any point there are two possible velocity. So the velocity field is two-valued here. Here, you see, because at each point you have the possibility of going. And this is why you can be incompressible in some sense, because these two velocities cancel to each other. I mean, the sum is zero. So it's incompressible in the sense, in a weak sense. That is, the volume is preserved because each time a particle goes to the left, there is a particle going to the right. So there is a balance. Now,
formula for the region where the velocity is one
value? Actually, this you can guess what is the solution here. Because
so
it's like.
Boundary
between when it starts becoming two-valued. Yeah, so I mean, here there is a self-similar behavior, and you can compute the power law of this curve. I don't remember which. I think. So numerically, it's not very, very good, but it is something like 3/2, I think, as far as I remember. That is, the t is this curve has a behavior in t is x to the 3/2 at this point. That you can find quite easily by a scaling argument, assuming that the kinetic energy is preserved, more or less. Okay, so this is another possible picture. And so if we do the same thing for the hat function, the numerics are quite different. If I can find it, it's easy. Yeah. And so now, instead of considering this final map, we do the other one, for instance. And then the picture is quite different for the trajectories. Get this? And it's quite similar to the previous one, because I mean the particle on the first half interval will cover the whole interval. So you see that on the left side you have the particle don't feel anything for a while, and then they flow smoothly to cover the whole interval. But here, because it's orientation reversing, they have to rotate in some sense. Because this particle will cover the whole interval at the end, but upside down. I mean, this particle will have to go there, and this one to go there. And so this is why you have this feeling of rotation, of curl, although it's one dimensional. Okay, so it's a kind of a curly flow in 1D. So this picture, this looks very strange, but this looks much more conventional because you have the feeling that this looks like the more or less a real flow projected. That is, you have the feeling that if I am able to extend to add an additional space variable, I could approximate that by a classical flow. And this, because I mean, we've seen this kind of picture. I mean, this, when you see a tornado, it looks a little bit like that, right? And what you see is a projection on a two-dimensional screen of a three-dimensional flow. So this looks like the projection of a two-dimensional flow on 1D. Except that, well, I'm cheating a little bit because this is a time axis. This is not a space axis. And actually, it is... I can show you the kind of picture we can expect if we use this... dimensional lifting, for instance, still for the same picture, right? So if we add, instead of considering just a one space interval, we add an extra dimension. So we can approximate that if we have the possibility to add an extra dimension, we can approximate this strange picture by a picture like this. So you have this green box corresponds to the left part of the interval, and so you can feel that there is a kind of potential motion, incompressible potential flow without curl, moving this green box to the end at the final time, cover one half of the box. And to approximate the orientation reversing map, well, we just need to have a curly flow like this. And so this gives you it's almost a proof, right, that you can approximate this kind of picture by a classical flow, provided you add one dimension. All right. And so for the potential, the other one. The other one, if I go back to the previous picture, okay, to this one, then by lifting we would get something like that. That is, we have two potential flow moving and separated by a vortex sheet. Okay. So I think this is enough with. And as I told you, maybe I just show you again this picture for the third case, where we flow from the identity map to the orientation reversing map, and then the solution is a full mixture in between. So I guess it's upside down. It's a full mixture, and it turns out that here we can do. We will show. I mean, there is an exact solution to this. This is this is analytically computable, and this is really an ellipse, right? Okay. So I think I don't need that anymore. Okay, I can go put that up. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about generalized solutions. And so there are two, actually there are two different ways of guessing what could be a generalized solution. The first one, which is inspired by the picture where we saw the trajectory, is that instead of classical description of a flow will be a map, time-dependent map depending on the x variable. And so this is a classical flow with a determinant of dx gtx is equal to 1. And with the initial position will be x, and the final position will be the given final map. This is a classical description. And according to the second set of pictures, we can see, maybe it can be seen for, this can be still seen on the blackboard. Okay, maybe, yeah, this is enough. You see that here, for a given initial point, you have clearly one trajectory. Here, for points that are very close to each other, there is a very strong dispersion. I mean, two particles very close to each other follow very different routes, roads. So in the limit, well, I mean, this is like in the Young's measure business. So we can expect that the solution will be like this, that there will be an extra parameter describing this mixture. That is, instead of going deterministically from x to h of x, you go from x of h of x according to different paths parameterized by omega. So what would be the requirements? So the first one would be that at time zero, the map is deterministic, doesn't depend on omega, and at the final time, we get h of x. And so what could be the equivalent of this equation? So you remember that this is in weak form, actually. This corresponds to a prescribed that the map is volume is measure preserving, which means that for all test function, this should be equal to, we should have this equality. And so now the new requirement will be that, so assume that the probability, I just used this notation d omega to say that this is the expectation with respect to omega. Okay. Actually, you can make it the Lebesgue measure if you wish. It's not a big deal. And this should be dx. This should be, so this is dx cross omega, where omega is a probability space. So the probability space is denoted by omega d omega. And this should be equal to phi of x, dx, right? And for the action, which was, in this case, the action was, well, I up to the factor 1/2, so let me put back the factor 1/2. It was the integral of d gtx square dt dx, space-time. And here, the natural extension would be to add the extra variable. But this doesn't work, actually. It works like this. Sorry, I'm mixing two different things. This is fine. Sorry. dt dx d omega. And we have to integrate on omega. Okay. And so we could try to do the minimization this way, and using a slightly different formulation, because here the problem doesn't look like a nice problem, not better than the previous one, but by in this framework, using a slightly different formulation, it's quite easy to get a minimizer. But this is not a very satisfactory description, and the one I'm going really to use for the rigorous result is slightly different. Actually, you can pass from this formulation to the next one if you wish. In many cases, slightly different approach. Because in some sense, this is a purely Lagrangian description. That is, you really care only about the trajectories of the particle. So, in this, the drawback of this formulation is there is no Eulerian field involved in some sense, because you have a given particle and you follow its trajectory, but there is no description of the fluid in an Eulerian fashion. So what we need is an approach combining Eulerian Lagrangian description. Here, Lagrangian means particle, because Lagrangian, Lagrange did so many things, so Lagrangian should be understood in the sense of particle. And Eulerian, or if you prefer, field description. And the most successful approach is the following. So we start from a classical flow, incompressible, G of T and X. And the first thing we do, we consider the following measure. So this, the starting point is really like Young's measure. So from now I will use a slightly different notation for X. I will use A for the initial position, for the initial position of the particle, or more generally for the label of the particle. Of a particle, and the X will stand for the Eulerian, the space variable. So in the vocabulary of fluid mechanics, this will be the Lagrangian coordinate and this will be the Eulerian coordinate. And so the first thing we can do, which is quite straightforward, is to consider this measure. Okay, I should... This measure that I will denote by C. Okay? So you should consider, I mean, notation for measures are always a little bit a problem, so I will use the notation as a function like this. So this is a non-negative measure on the space of Eulerian position and label. So I will use the letter capital A for the label, which is a little bit confusing with the action, so let me use this notation. And of course, you can take, using as a label the initial position, you could consider that as to be D. But, so this is the first thing. So this is really the same embedding as in the framework of calculus of variation when you replace function by Young's measure. It's more or less the same. Except that the target space is very special because it's the motion of a particle, so the values of the function is a point in the domain D. But this is not enough to have a successful description, so we need a second measure, which I will denote by M, which is a vector-valued measure, which is the same as the first one, multiplied by the velocity of the particle. So this is a vector-valued measure. Which is absolutely continuous with respect to C. To C. And This will be the efficient way of embedding classical flow into generalized flow. And actually, this is if you are familiar with the theory of currents, this is a very particular case in some sense. It's a particular case of a current associated to a geometric object, actually. But it's not. I mean, you don't need that. But it's just for people interested in that. You can put that in the framework of current if you wish. Okay. So now we have to consider all the property of the classical flow and to try to see what they mean in terms of C and M. Okay. So the boundary condition in time are very easy to translate. So we have. So this becomes just the fact that at time zero, x and a is delta x minus a. Okay, that at the final time, okay, technically it is slightly better to use to keep the possibility of using A as something else than the initial position. So here this is just the initial position of the particle. But you can, for simplicity, you can consider that this is A, if you prefer. And for the final map, it should be something like H of I of A, if you wish. Okay, at one. I forgot to say there is a very important compatibility condition between C and M, which is one of the key things in the story, is that in the distributional sense we have DTC plus nabla in X dot M is zero. And this is an equation in X, so this is more or less an equation true for all A, more or less, right? So you see that. So why is it true? Well, you just, for instance, you do that by either directly or using a test function, and you see that the DTC will compensate the divergence of M, actually. Well, if you do DTC, you have the gradient of delta times minus DTG, and if you take the divergence of M, you will get the same DTG dot the gradient of delta. So this cancels out. And of course, you can put this free condition in a weak form by saying that for all phi, integrating this by part, so we will get that phi txa dc txa plus dt phi plus grad phi txa dot dm txa should be equal to the integral of phi at 1 x a, and you use the boundary condition, so this will be h of I a dA minus phi of 0 I of A dA. Yeah. So this is a weak way of expressing the compatibility condition between C and M and the boundary condition. Now, the second step is the incompressibility condition. So the incompressibility condition amounts to say that when you integrate C, this measure T and X, with respect to the variable A, you take the marginal with respect to A. So let me use, I hope this notation is not too confusing. So this means that you just integrate in A, okay, on the set of labels. and this should be equal to, let me do that in the weak way, it's simpler actually. So let's compute this when the test function doesn't depend on A. Right? Okay, so using the formula, we see that this is the same as phi t g t a dA. And therefore, by the volume preserving property, this is phi of t and x dx. And so there is a dt missing. So the incompressibility condition, so let me get rid of that, is expressed by this property, which really means that the marginal of C, when we integrate out the variable A, is just the Lebesgue measure. So the nice thing is that this condition is linear in C, which was of course not the case of the previous incompressibility condition. So now the last thing to do is to compute the action of G, which was, you remember, the double integral of dt gta square dt dA. But this can be interpreted as the L2 norm of the density of M with respect to C, with respect to C, actually. So this is the same as one half of the density. So let me call, well, I will explain in a second. So this can be written as VTXA square DCTXA, where V is the density of M with respect to C. In other words, you can say that V is in L2 with respect to the measure C. Right? And there is the possibility of... So this is not very nice, but... this can be also written in a much nicer way by noticing that this is formally one half of m squared divided by c, right, dc. And this can be defined rigorously as a convex function of c and m by using Legendre duality. In a very simple way, this is just the supremum of the integral of alpha txa dc txa plus beta txa dot dm txa for all pair of continuous function alpha beta satisfying pointwise the inequality alpha plus one half of beta square less than zero. So I mean, it's not so hard to see, because I mean, since C is a non-negative measure, you see that I can saturate the supremum by taking alpha is minus one half of beta square, and then using the factorization of M as V dc, you see that this is like the supremum of minus one half of beta square plus beta dot V dc. And so the best values is when beta is equal to V, and so you get back to this expression. Okay. And so I will denote this functional like this, K, C, and M. Okay. And so what I'm going to do is really to do an embedding of classical flow into generalized flow and to see what are the properties inherited by the measure C and M from the classical flow. And we see that now we have, if we forget that C and M were generated by a classical flow, so we now have a natural definition for the generalized shortest path problem. So the idea is very simple. You just relax the structure condition that C was built as delta of with respect to some classical flow, and keep all those other so relax the structure condition and keep the other condition. So which means that the problem now it's very simple. It's just to find the infimum of KCM for all pair CM satisfying this condition and that condition. So and this is a fairly easy convex minimization problem. Because you see that by definition, this is a supremum of a linear function in C and M. So this is convex, lower semi-continuous, no problem at all. And these are linear conditions. So it's almost trivial that there is a solution. The only thing to check is that K, C, and M, that this is not always plus infinity. Because in some sense, I should say that a little bit more detail about K, that you have a lemma like this, or proposition, that K, C, and M, if you have a pair of for all pair of measure of C, M, and here I don't assume C to be non-negative, so this is a pair of real and vector valued measure. Right, so C is valued in R and M in RD. And so the KCM is finite, is equal to plus infinity, unless, first of all, C is non-negative. Two, M is absolutely continuous with respect to C. Three, the density is a square integrable with respect to C. And then, in that case, KC and M is just one half of the integral of V squared dC. Right? And this is not difficult to prove. So in some sense, I can do the minimization without any other constraint than this one, that 1 and 2. So I don't even need to take care of the non-negativeness of C, because it's automatically enforced when K is finite. So the only thing I have to do to get a minimizer is to show that K is not always infinite, so which is a quite simple problem. And actually, you can compute on the unit cube, you can compute an upper bound for the... So you have a second proposition that this number, which depends on H, right? So the infimum of KCM is bounded by an explicit constant that I forgot, but it is... let me try to find it. it's oh yeah, it is here. I think it's free. Like that. And so the and therefore there is always a minimizer. At least one minimizer for each A. H. Yeah, this is in case of the cube, you're right. Okay. And so it is not completely obvious to find this bound, because if you, okay, let me anticipate a little bit. If you assume that this is the right framework to solve the classical problem, the natural, which is not obvious at all, because I have done a huge relaxation of the problem, right? Because I have thrown away the property that C is built on classical flow. But assume for a moment that this is a relevant framework. This would imply that the geodesic diameter of the group of volume-preserving map on the cube is bounded by 3, something like that. So, which is not completely obvious to prove, right, directly. And so, but with in the framework of generalized flow, it is fairly easy to do. Actually, the idea, so the idea of the proof here is the following. So, Maria's question was very relevant, because you start by doing the construction on the torus. So you start with RD over ZD on the torus, and on the torus there is a way to connect two volume preserving map in an incompressible fashion with a control energy. And the idea is the following. So I try to do the drawing in a symbolic way. So this is a time axis from 1 to 0. And so the idea is, you are on the torus here. You take a point, A, and so you build the generalized flow in the following way. So you send the particle uniformly on the torus, along the geodesics of the torus, uniformly. So, I mean, the picture is a bit complicated, something like that. Right? You send each particle, you blow up each particle, and you send each particle to cover the full torus, following a geodesic curve on the torus, straight line, but you have to take care of the periodicity of the torus. And then you reach the final point in the same way. Right? And if you do that for all points, there is a nice cancellation, and it turns out that this generalized flow satisfies this condition, because of the invariance by translation of the Lebesgue measure on the torus. So you achieve something which is not a classical flow at all, but which gives you the possibility to go from one configuration to any configuration, and it's very easy to control the price you have to pay for that. And once you have done that for the torus, then you in some sense you cover you cover the cube by a finite number of copies of the torus, and you can make it.
You don't use a real trajectory. You use a generalized trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. This is a soft result, because I do that in the generalized framework. And if you would try to do that with classical flow, I think it would be quite difficult, and to get the bound. And so this is like an elementary computation. Of course, it is not sharp, because in some sense you go through an intermediate situation. So in terms of if I use the notation C, the intermediate C is completely mixed up. So the C at one half is just dx dA. It's the uniform measure in some sense. Everybody goes to everywhere. So in some sense it means that if you on the family of of a generalized flow, it means that you go from the identity map to H through always through the some kind of north pole, which will be this measure. Right. Which is, nearly optimal when you go from Vancouver to maybe to Northern Europe, I don't know. Or to
anywhere in the world.
Yeah. To pims from everywhere in the world.
But does this mean that if you restrict your class to the real flows, then this might be infinite?
Ah. No, that's a very good point, because there is, yeah. If you are in 2D, for instance, this is, maybe I can answer the question in the... No, precisely because in some sense there is a huge difference between the 3D case and the 2D case. In the 2D case, the geodesic diameter is infinite. So there is a huge gap in the 2D case between the generalized solution and the classical solution. But in the 3D case, they match. So if you try to do that by hand with classical flow, it will be very hard to do in 2D because it's wrong. It's infinite. Yeah. So in order to get that, so to do a classical proof, you would have to compute a quite complicated flow, which would be in some kind of approximation of that, actually. But this is hard to... I don't know how to do it exactly. This would be a good idea to see how you can make this kind of construction without relying on the weak limits in a more classical way. And in 3D, you should be able to. I mean, you should end up below this number. But in 2D, no way. And in 2D, I am not familiar with that. But in the so I should put some remarks in the classical framework. The geodesic diameter of is infinite for d equal to 2. And this has to do with symplectic geometry, because in 2D the volume preserving map are area preserving map, and they are actually the smooth map are symplectomorphism. And this was proved in a paper of Eliasberg and Ratiu. Reasons are symplectics. Comes from actually there is an invariant that you can compute, and you can show that there are symplectomorphisms that are arbitrarily far from each other. So, and okay, by the way, it's not a problem of connection. I mean, I am talking about, when I say classical, I always assume that we are talking about maps that can be reached from the identity map, right? So it's not a matter of being connected to the identity map. It's a matter of how long it takes to reach the identity map, how much energy it takes to reach the identity map. And it can be as big as you wish in 2D. Okay, so I just... So tomorrow I will... I mean, this is so far it is really soft. So the thing we are left to do is, first of all, to go further, we have to explain how this construction is relevant in the 3D case, that in some sense there is no gap between generalized solution and classical solution. And... also, more interestingly, we would like to compute the optimality equation, because, I mean, it is not very satisfactory to have the existence result. I mean, we wish to know what are the equations solved by C and M. And the major output of this analysis, in my opinion, is the fact that the out of these generalized objects, we get the existence and the uniqueness of a much more classical object, which is a pressure field. That is, we will show that there exists a gradient of pressure which doesn't depend on this microstructure, this internal variable. So it's really a classical field coming out of that. And in addition, because of the fact that the problem is a convex problem, it's more or less a linear programming problem, we get the uniqueness of the pressure almost for free, which in the classical framework, I think it is not clear to me how you can get this kind of result. That is, you can have several shortest paths going to a different, to a prescribed point, and the claim is that the pressure field will be always the same. That is, you can follow different trajectory, but the acceleration field doesn't depend on these trajectories. Okay, thank you.
There is a kind of dialogue between the minimization problem and the Cauchy problem. In other words, did you try to put the Cauchy problem with this kind of, to study Cauchy problem with this kind of generalized solution?
Yeah, that's a very important question, because you notice that this is a minimization problem in space-time. And we end up with the candidates to solve the problem is a convex minimization problem. So this is really scaring, because in general, if you have a strictly convex functional and you are minimizing space-time, you should end up with an elliptic equation space-time. So which means that the dynamical equation will be ill-posed. And so the Euler equation is... I should say, of course, from this you can see the Euler equation as a purely variational equation, and so its type could be elliptic or hyperbolic, but classically for the evolution equation, we would prefer by far that Euler equation is more an hyperbolic equation, well posed in time. Okay, so it's very dangerous, because what we could get through this process is solutions that are completely irrelevant, because unstable or not dynamically stable. And it's actually partly true. But fortunately, there is a non-empty intersection between the solutions that are dynamically meaningful and the solutions that are variationally meaningful. And this is due to the fact that the convex functional which is here, from this definition you can see that it's homogeneous of degree 1. So it's very flat, actually. And so... there is a room, so the Euler equation is a very bizarre equation, because it can be considered as an equation. In some sense, it has some elliptic feature and hyperbolic features. And actually, this is already known by the people working on, for instance, vortex sheets equation that are ill-posed, and there are some other recent results by Wu and Lebeau, showing that the Euler equation have a lot of elliptic features. And so I hope... there is a narrow intersection between the two frameworks. So there is a class of solution of this type that are also dynamically well-posed, but limited class.
So I mean, there is hope to get relevant results?
No. This is a very important question. Why? Because the minimization problems provide a little bit of regularity. So in some sense, the fact that it's in a very extended sense still a little bit elliptic space-time, very degenerate, but still a little bit elliptic, there is a little bit of regularity. And for instance, the only irregularity I have obtained so far is the fact that the gradient of pressure is a measure. And if you would try to do the similar analysis with this kind of Young's measure on a sequence of solution of Navier-Stokes, for instance, you take a family of Lorentz solution of the Navier-Stokes equation with a vanishing viscosity, and you try to do the same kind of analysis, well, it is not completely obvious to do, but you could try with the same C and M and to try whether you can pass through the limits. And there are many failures. If you try to do that, first of all, you never get that the gradient of P is a measure. You would barely get that P is something like L1 or a measure. But here, the minimization process gives you one more derivative of smoothness. The second feature is this: in this framework, the kinetic energy properly defined is preserved in time. And this is a kind of result you cannot expect if you pass to the limit on the Navier-Stokes solution. So many people think that there are dissipation of kinetic energy. Possibly. And so these equations are energy preserving in time. So they are much smoother in some sense than what you would expect from the evolution equation if you use the compactness method by brute force, not trying to solve the problem in classical solution. The strategy that, for instance, Diperna and Maeda used in the 80s with the measure valued solution. Yeah.
That question. One thing that is intriguing me when you tried this third dimension and had these loop kinds of flows, couldn't there be a less radical relaxation by just going on to kind of two sheets, or would that only be for a special case?
For instance, if you remember, there was a solution which looked like a two-sheet solution. So in that case, you can consider that this is like... you could consider that as a two-phase flow, more or less, in one dimension. Actually, multiphasic flows are used in one dimension, and nobody complained about them. But they are explaining, it's very similar. It's actually the equation we will get are, in some sense, multiphasic equations. But if you wish to describe, for instance, the solution with vorticity, I think the internal degree of freedom is one, you have one parameter to add. And so I guess you need a continuum of sheets. So therefore you have to add an extra dimension, I think. Come on.
Questions?